benefits of easy and quick victory. So, liar genes would spread. When liars became the majority, selection would now favor individuals who called their bluff. Therefore, liars would decrease in numbers again. In the war of attrition, telling lies is no more evolutionarily stable than telling the truth. The poker face is evolutionarily stable. Surrender, when it finally comes, will be sudden and unpredictable. So far, we've considered only what Maynard Smith calls symmetric contests. This means we have assumed that the contestants are identical in all respects except their fighting strategy. Hawks and doves are assumed to be equally strong, to be equally well endowed with weapons and with armor, and to have an equal amount to gain from winning. This is a convenient assumption to make for a model, but it is not very realistic. Parker and Maynard Smith went on to consider asymmetric contests. For example, if individuals vary in size and fighting ability, and each individual is capable of gauging a rival size in comparison to his own, does this affect the ESS that emerges? It most certainly does. There seem to be three main sorts of asymmetry. The first we've just met. Individuals may differ in their size or fighting equipment. Secondly, individuals may differ in how much they have to gain from winning. For instance, an old male who has not long to live anyway, might have less to lose if he is injured than a young male with the bulk of his reproductive life ahead of him. Thirdly, it is a strange consequence of the theory that a purely arbitrary, apparently irrelevant asymmetry can give rise to an ESS, since it can be used to settle contests quickly. For instance, it will usually be the case that one contestant happens to arrive at the location of the contest earlier than the other. Call them resident and intruder, respectively. For the sake of argument, I'm assuming that there is no general advantage attached to being a resident or an intruder. As we shall see, there are practical reasons why this assumption may not be true, but that's not the point. The point is that even if there were no general reason to suppose that residents have an advantage over intruders, an ESS depending on the asymmetry itself would be likely to evolve. A simple analogy is to humans who settle a dispute quickly and without fuss by tossing a coin. The conditional strategy, if you are the resident attack, if you are the intruder retreat, could be an ESS. Since the asymmetry is assumed to be arbitrary, the opposite strategy, if resident retreat, if intruder attack, could also be stable. Which of the two ESSs is adopted in a particular population would depend on which one happens to reach a majority first. Once a majority of individuals is playing one of these two conditional strategies, deviants from it are penalized. Hence, by definition, it is an ESS. For instance, suppose all individuals are playing resident wins, intruder runs away. This means they will win half their fights and lose half their fights. They will never be injured and they will never waste time, since all disputes are instantly settled by arbitrary convention. Now consider a new mutant rebel. Suppose he plays a pure hawk strategy, always attacking and never retreating. He will win when his opponent is an intruder. When his opponent is a resident, he will run a grave risk of injury. On average, he will have a lower payoff than individuals playing according to the arbitrary rules of the ESS. A rebel who tries the reverse convention, if resident run away, if intruder attack, will do even worse. Not only will he frequently be injured, he will also seldom win a contest. Suppose, though, that by some chance events, individuals playing this reverse convention manage to become the majority. In this case, their strategy would then become the stable norm, and deviation from it would be penalized. Conceivably, if we watched a population for many generations, we would see a series of occasional flips from one stable state to the other. However, in real life, truly arbitrary asymmetries probably do not exist. For instance, residents probably tend to have a practical advantage over intruders. They have better knowledge of local terrain. An intruder is perhaps more likely to be out of breath because he moved into the battle area, whereas the resident was there all the time. There is a more abstract reason why, of the two stable states, the resident wins, intruder retreats one is the more probable in nature. This is that the reverse strategy, intruder wins, resident retreats, has an inherent tendency to self-destruction. It is what Maynard Smith would call a paradoxical strategy. In any population sitting at this paradoxical ESS, individuals would always be striving never to be caught as residents. They would always be trying to be the intruder in any encounter. They could only achieve this by ceaseless and otherwise pointless moving around. Quite apart from the costs in time and energy that would be incurred, this evolutionary trend would, of itself, tend to lead to the category resident ceasing to exist. In a population sitting at the other stable state, resident wins intruder retreats, natural selection would favor individuals who strove to be residents. For each individual, this would mean holding on to a particular piece of ground, leaving it as little as possible and appearing to defend it. As is now well known, such behavior is commonly observed in nature and goes by the name of territorial defense. The neatest demonstration I know of this form of behavioral asymmetry was provided by the great ethologist Nico Tinbergen in an experiment of characteristically ingenious simplicity.
Tinbergen had a fish tank containing two male sticklebacks. The males had each built nests at opposite ends of the tank, and each defended the territory around his own nest. Tinbergen placed each of the two males in a large glass test tube, and he held the two tubes next to each other and watched the males trying to fight each other through the glass. Now comes the interesting result. When he moved the two tubes into the vicinity of male A's nest, male A assumed an attacking posture and male B attempted to retreat. But when he moved the two tubes into male B's territory, the tables were turned. By simply moving the two tubes from one end of the tank to the other, Tinbergen was able to dictate which male attacked and which retreated. Both males were evidently playing the simple conditional strategy: if resident, attack; if intruder, retreat.
End note. An even clearer demonstration than Tinbergen's of the resident always wins phenomenon comes from N.B. Davies's research on speckled wood butterflies. Tinbergen's work was done before ESS theory was invented, and my ESS interpretation in the first edition of this book was made with hindsight. Davies conceived his butterfly study in the light of ESS theory. He noticed that individual male butterflies in Whiteham Wood near Oxford defended patches of sunlight. Females were attracted to sun patches, so a sun patch was a valuable resource, something worth fighting over. There were more males than sun patches, and the surplus waited their chance in the leafy canopy. By catching males and releasing them one after the other, Davies showed that whichever of two individuals was released first into a sun patch was treated by both individuals as the owner. Whichever male arrived second in the sun patch was treated as the intruder. The intruder always, without exception, promptly conceded defeat, leaving the owner in sole control. In a final coup de grace experiment, Davies managed to fool both butterflies into thinking that they were the owner and the other was the intruder. Only under these conditions did a really serious, prolonged fight break out. By the way, in all those cases where, for simplicity, I've spoken as though there was a single pair of butterflies, there was really, of course, a statistical sample of pairs.
Biologists often ask what the biological advantages of territorial behaviour are. Numerous suggestions have been made, some of which will be mentioned later. But we can now see that the very question may be superfluous. Territorial defence may simply be an ESS which arises because of the asymmetry in time of arrival that usually characterizes the relationship between two individuals and a patch of ground. Presumably the most important kind of non-arbitrary asymmetry is in size and general fighting ability. Large size is not necessarily always the most important quality needed to win fights, but it's probably one of them. If the larger of two fighters always wins, and if each individual knows for certain whether he is larger or smaller than his opponent, only one strategy makes any sense. If your opponent is larger than you, run away. Pick fights with people smaller than you are. Things are a bit more complicated if the importance of size is less certain. If large size confers only a slight advantage, the strategy just mentioned is still stable. But if the risk of injury is serious, there may also be a second, paradoxical strategy. This is, pick fights with people larger than you are and run away from people smaller than you are. It is obvious why this is called paradoxical. It seems completely counter to common sense. The reason it can be stable is this. In a population consisting entirely of paradoxical strategists, nobody ever gets hurt. This is because in every contest, one of the participants, the larger, always runs away. A mutant of average size who plays the sensible strategy of picking on smaller opponents is involved in a seriously escalated fight with half the people he meets. This is because if he meets somebody smaller than him, he attacks. The smaller individual fights back fiercely because he is playing paradoxical. Although the sensible strategist is more likely to win than the paradoxical one, he still runs a substantial risk of losing and of being seriously injured. Since the majority of the population are paradoxical, a sensible strategist is more likely to be injured than any single paradoxical strategist. Even though a paradoxical strategy can be stable, it is probably only of academic interest. Paradoxical fighters will only have a higher average payoff if they very heavily outnumber sensible ones. It's hard to imagine how this state of affairs could ever arise in the first place. Even if it did, the ratio of sensibles to paradoxicals in the population only has to drift a little way towards the sensible side before reaching the zone of attraction of the other ESS, the sensible one. The zone of attraction is the set of population ratios at which, in this case, sensible strategists have the advantage. Once a population reaches this zone, it will be sucked inevitably towards the sensible stable point. It would be exciting to find an example of a paradoxical ESS in nature, but it seems unlikely.
Just after I'd written this last sentence, Professor Maynard Smith called my attention to the following description of the behaviour of the Mexican social spider Ecobius civitas by J.W. Burgess.
If a spider is disturbed and driven out of its retreat, it darts across the rock and, in the absence of a vacant crevice to hide in, may seek refuge in the hiding place of another spider of the same species. If the other spider is in residence when the intruder enters, it does not attack, but darts out and seeks a new refuge of its own. Thus, once the first spider is disturbed, the process of sequential displacement from web to web may continue for several seconds, often causing a majority of the spiders in the aggregation to shift from their home refuge to an alien one.
End note. Another incident that conceivably might represent a paradoxical ESS was recorded in a letter to The Times, 7th of December 1977, from a Mr. James Dawson. For some years I have noticed that a gull using a flagpole as a vantage point invariably makes way for another gull wishing to alight on the post, and this irrespectively of the size of the two birds. The most satisfying example of a paradoxical strategy known to me involves domestic pigs in a Skinner box. The strategy is stable in the same sense as an ESS, but it is better called a DSS, developmentally stable strategy, because it arises during the animal's own lifetime rather than over evolutionary time. A Skinner box is an apparatus in which an animal learns to feed itself by pressing a lever, food then being automatically delivered down a chute. Experimental psychologists are accustomed to putting pigeons or rats in small Skinner boxes, where they soon learn to press delicate little levers for a food reward. Pigs can learn the same thing in a scaled-up Skinner box with a very undelicate snout lever. I saw a research film of this many years ago, and I well recall almost dying of laughter. B.A. Baldwin and G.B. Mees trained pigs in a Skinner sty, but there is an added twist to the tale. The snout lever was at one end of the sty, the food dispenser at the other. So the pig had to press the lever, then race up to the other end of the sty to get the food, then rush back to the lever, and so on. This sounds all very well, but Baldwin and Mees put pairs of pigs into the apparatus. It now became possible for one pig to exploit the other. The slave pig rushed back and forth pressing the bar. Master Pig sat by the food chute and ate the food as it was dispensed. Pairs of pigs did indeed settle down into a stable master-slave pattern of this kind, one working and one running, the other doing most of the eating. Now for the paradox. The labels master and slave turned out to be all topsy-turvy. Whenever a pair of pigs settled down to a stable pattern, the pig that ended up playing the master or exploiting role was the pig that, in all other ways, was subordinate. The so-called slave pig, the one that did all the work, was the pig that was usually dominant. Anybody knowing the pigs would have predicted that, on the contrary, the dominant pig would have been the master. Doing most of the eating, the subordinate pig should have been the hard-working and scarcely eating slave. How could this paradoxical reversal arise? It is easy to understand once you start thinking in terms of stable strategies. All that we have to do is scale the idea down from evolutionary time to developmental time, the time scale on which a relationship between two individuals develops. The strategy, if dominant, sit by the food trough, if subordinate, work the lever, sounds sensible, but would not be stable. The subordinate pig, having pressed the lever, would come sprinting over, only to find the dominant pig with its front feet firmly in the trough and impossible to dislodge. The subordinate pig would soon give up pressing the lever, for the habit would never be rewarded. But now consider the reverse strategy. If dominant, work the lever, if subordinate, sit by the food trough. This would be stable, even though it has the paradoxical result that the subordinate pig gets most of the food. All that is necessary is that there should be some food left for the dominant pig when he charges up from the other end of the sty. As soon as he arrives, he has no difficulty in tossing the subordinate pig out of the trough. As long as there is a crumb left to reward him, his habit of working the lever and thereby inadvertently stuffing the subordinate pig will persist. And the subordinate pig's habit of reclining idly by the trough is rewarded too. So the whole strategy, if dominant behave as a slave, if subordinate behave as a master, is rewarded and therefore stable.
What if individuals retain some memory of the outcome of past fights? This depends on whether the memory is specific or general. Crickets have a general memory of what happened in past fights. A cricket that has recently won a large number of fights becomes more hawkish. A cricket that has recently had a losing streak becomes more dovish. This was neatly shown by R.D. Alexander. He used a model cricket to beat up real crickets. After this treatment, the real crickets became more likely to lose fights against other real crickets. Each cricket can be thought of as constantly updating his own estimate of his fighting ability relative to that of an average individual in his population. If animals such as crickets, who work with a general memory of past fights, are kept together in a closed group for a time, a kind of dominance hierarchy is likely to develop.
End note. Ted Burke, then my graduate student, found further evidence for this kind of pseudo-dominance hierarchy in crickets. He also showed that a male cricket is more likely to court females if he has recently won a fight against another male. This should be called the Duke of Marlborough effect, after the following entry in the diary of the first Duchess of Marlborough.
His Grace returned from the wars today, and pleasured me twice in his top boots.
An alternative name might be suggested by the following report from the magazine New Scientist about changes in levels of the masculine hormone testosterone. Levels doubled in tennis players during the 24 hours before a big match. Afterwards, the levels in winners stayed up, but in losers they'd dropped.
An observer of crickets can rank the individuals in order. Individuals lower in the order tend to give in to individuals higher in the order. There's no need to suppose that the individuals recognize each other. All that happens is that individuals who are accustomed to winning become even more likely to win, while individuals who are accustomed to losing become steadily more likely to lose. Even if the individuals started by winning or losing entirely at random, they would tend to sort themselves out into a rank order. This, incidentally, has the effect that the number of serious fights in the group gradually dies down.
I have to use the phrase kind of dominance hierarchy because many people reserve the term dominance hierarchy for cases in which individual recognition is involved. In these cases, memory of past fights is specific rather than general. Crickets do not recognize each other as individuals, but hens and monkeys do. If you are a monkey who has beaten you in the past is likely to beat you in the future. The best strategy for an individual is to be relatively dovish towards an individual who has previously beaten him. If a batch of hens who have never met before are introduced to each other, there is usually a great deal of fighting. After a time, the fighting dies down. Not for the same reason as in the crickets, though. In the case of the hens, it is because each individual learns her place relative to each other individual. This is, incidentally, good for the group as a whole. As an indicator of this, it has been noticed that in established groups of hens, where fierce fighting is rare, egg production is higher than in groups of hens whose membership is continually being changed and in which fights are consequently more frequent. Biologists often speak of the biological advantage or function of dominance hierarchies as being to reduce overt aggression in the group. However, this is the wrong way to put it. A dominance hierarchy per se cannot be said to have a function in the evolutionary sense, since it is a property of a group, not of an individual. The individual behavior patterns that manifest themselves in the form of dominance hierarchies when viewed at the group level may be said to have functions. It is, however, even better to abandon the word function altogether and to think about the matter in terms of ESSs in asymmetric contests where there is individual recognition and memory. We've been thinking of contests between members of the same species. What about interspecific contests? As we saw earlier, members of different species are less direct competitors than members of the same species. For this reason, we should expect fewer disputes between them over resources, and our expectation is borne out. For instance, robins defend territories against other robins, but not against great tits. One can draw a map of the territories of different individual robins in a wood, and one can superimpose a map of the territories of individual great tits. The territories of the two species overlap in an entirely indiscriminate way. They might as well be on different planets. But there are other ways in which the interests of individuals from different species conflict very sharply. For instance, a lion wants to eat an antelope's body, but the antelope has very different plans for its body. This is not normally regarded as competition for a resource, but logically it is hard to see why not. The resource in question is meat. The lion genes want the meat as food for their survival machine. The antelope genes want the meat as working muscle and organs for their survival machine. These two uses for the meat are mutually incompatible. Therefore, there is conflict of interest. Members of one's own species are made of meat too. Why is cannibalism relatively rare? As we saw in the case of black-headed gulls, adults do sometimes eat the young of their own species. Yet adult carnivores are never to be seen actively pursuing other adults of their own species with a view to eating them. Why not? We are still so used to thinking in terms of the good of the species view of evolution that we often forget to ask perfectly reasonable questions like, why don't lions hunt other lions? Another good question of a type which is seldom asked is, why do antelopes run away from lions instead of hitting back?
The reason lions do not hunt lions is that it would not be an ESS for them to do so. A cannibal strategy would be unstable for the same reason as the hawk strategy in the earlier example. There's too much danger of retaliation. This is less likely to be true in contests between members of different species, which is why so many prey animals run away instead of retaliating. It probably stems originally from the fact that in an interaction between two animals of different species, there is a built-in asymmetry which is greater than that between members of the same species. Whenever there is strong asymmetry in a contest, ESSs are likely to be conditional strategies dependent on the asymmetry. Strategies analogous to if smaller, run away, if larger, attack, are very likely to evolve in contests between members of different species because there are so many available asymmetries.
Lions and antelopes have reached a kind of stability by evolutionary divergence, which has accentuated the original asymmetry of the contest in an ever-increasing fashion. They've become highly proficient in the arts of, respectively, chasing and running away. A mutant antelope that adopted a stand-and-fight strategy against lions would be less successful than rival antelopes disappearing over the horizon. We may well come to look back on the invention of the ESS concept as one of the most important advances in evolutionary theory since Darwin.
End note. This sentence is a bit over the top. I was probably overreacting to the then prevalent neglect of the ESS idea in the contemporary biological literature, especially in America. The term does not occur anywhere in E.O. Wilson's massive book Sociobiology, for instance. It is neglected no longer, and I can now take a more judicious and less evangelical view. You don't actually have to use ESS language, provided you think clearly enough. But it is a great aid to thinking clearly, especially in those cases, which in practice is most cases, where detailed genetic knowledge is not available. It is sometimes said that ESS models assume that reproduction is asexual, but this statement is misleading if taken to mean a positive assumption of asexual as opposed to sexual reproduction. The truth is rather that ESS models don't bother to commit themselves about the details of the genetic system. Instead, they assume that, in some vague sense, like begets like. For many purposes, this assumption is adequate. Indeed, its vagueness can even be beneficial, since it concentrates the mind on essentials and away from details, such as genetic dominance, which are usually unknown in particular cases. ESS thinking is most useful in a negative role. It helps us to avoid theoretical errors that might otherwise tempt us.
The ESS concept is applicable wherever we find conflict of interest, and that means almost everywhere. Students of animal behaviour have got into the habit of talking about something called social organisation. Too often, the social organisation of a species is treated as an entity in its own right, with its own biological advantage. An example we've already met is that of the dominance hierarchy.
I believe it is possible to discern hidden group selectionist assumptions lying behind a large number of the statements that biologists make about social organisation. Maynard Smith's concept of the ESS will enable us, for the first time, to see clearly how a collection of independent, selfish entities can come to resemble a single, organized whole. I think this will be true not only of social organizations within species, but also of ecosystems and communities consisting of many species. In the long term, I expect the ESS concept to revolutionize the science of ecology. We can also apply it to a matter that was deferred earlier, arising from the analogy of oarsmen in a boat, representing genes in a body, needing a good team spirit. Genes are selected not as good in isolation, but as good at working against the background of the other genes in the gene pool. A good gene must be compatible with, and complementary to, the other genes with whom it has to share a long succession of bodies. A gene for plant-grinding teeth is a good gene in the gene pool of a herbivorous species, but a bad gene in the gene pool of a carnivorous species. It is possible to imagine a compatible combination of genes as being selected together as a unit. In the case of the butterfly mimicry example of Chapter 3, this seems to be exactly what happened. But the power of the ESS concept is that it can now enable us to see how the same kind of result could be achieved by selection purely at the level of the independent gene. The genes do not have to be linked on the same chromosome.
The rowing analogy is really not up to explaining this idea. The nearest we can come to it is this. Suppose it is important in a really successful crew that the rowers should coordinate their activities by means of speech. Suppose further that in the pool of oarsmen at the coach's disposal, some speak only English and some speak only German. The English are not consistently better or worse rowers than the Germans. But because of the importance of communication, a mixed crew will tend to win fewer races than either a pure English crew or a pure German crew. The coach does not realize this. All he does is shuffle his men around, giving credit points to individuals in winning boats, marking down individuals in losing boats. Now, if the pool available to him just happens to be dominated by Englishmen, it follows that any German who gets into a boat is likely to cause it to lose because communications break down. Conversely, if the pool happened to be dominated by Germans, an Englishman would tend to cause any boat in which he found himself to lose. What will emerge as the overall best crew will be one of the two stable states, pure English or pure German, but not mixed. Superficially, it looks as though the coach is selecting whole language groups as units. This is not what he is doing. He is selecting individual oarsmen for their apparent ability to win races. It so happens that the tendency for an individual to win races depends on which other individuals are present in the pool of candidates. Minority candidates are automatically penalized, not because they are bad rowers, but simply because they are minority candidates. Similarly, the fact that genes are selected for mutual compatibility does not necessarily mean we have to think of groups of genes as being selected as units, as they were in the case of the butterflies. Selection at the low level of the single gene can give the impression of selection at some higher level. In this example, selection favours simple conformity. More interestingly, genes may be selected because they complement each other. In terms of the analogy, suppose an ideally balanced crew would consist of 4 right-handers and 4 left-handers. Once again, assume that the coach, unaware of this fact, selects blindly on merit. Now, if the pool of candidates happens to be dominated by right-handers, any individual left-hander will tend to be at an advantage. He is likely to cause any boat in which he finds himself to win, and he will therefore appear to be a good oarsman. Conversely, in a pool dominated by left-handers, a right-hander would have an advantage. This is similar to the case of a hawk doing well in a population of doves and a dove doing well in a population of hawks. The difference is that there we were talking about interactions between individual bodies, selfish machines, whereas here we are talking, by analogy, about interactions between genes within bodies. The coach's blind selection of apparently good oarsmen will lead, in the end, to an ideal crew consisting of 4 left-handers and 4 right-handers. It will look as though he selected them altogether as a complete, balanced unit. But it might be more parsimonious to think of him as selecting at a lower level, the level of the independent candidates. The evolutionarily stable state, strategy is misleading in this context, of 4 left-handers and 4 right-handers will emerge simply as a consequence of low-level selection on the basis of apparent merit. The gene pool is the long-term environment of the gene. Good genes are blindly selected as those that survive in the gene pool. This is not a theory. It is not even an observed fact. It is a tautology. The interesting question is, what makes a gene good? As a first approximation, what makes a gene good is the ability to build efficient survival machines, bodies. We must now amend that statement. The gene pool will become an evolutionarily stable set of genes defined as a gene pool that cannot be invaded by any new gene. Most new genes that arise, either by mutation or reassortment or immigration, are quickly penalized by natural selection. The evolutionarily stable set is restored. Occasionally, a new gene does succeed in invading the set. It succeeds in spreading through the gene pool. There is a transitional period of instability, terminating in a new evolutionarily stable set. A little bit of evolution has occurred. By analogy with the aggression strategies, a population might have more than one alternative stable point, and it might occasionally flip from one to another. Progressive evolution may be not so much a steady upward climb as a series of discrete steps from stable plateau to stable plateau. It may look as though the population as a whole is behaving like a single self-regulating unit, but this illusion is produced by selection going on at the level of the single gene. Genes are selected on merit, but merit is judged on the basis of performance against the background of the evolutionarily stable set, which is the current gene pool.
End note. I'm ashamed to say that when I wrote my conjecture about discrete steps from stable plateau to stable plateau, I, like many biologists in England at the time, was totally ignorant of the now well-known theory of punctuated equilibrium, although it had been published 3 years earlier. I have since, for instance in The Blind Watchmaker, become somewhat petulant, perhaps too much so, over the way the theory of punctuated equilibrium has been oversold. If this has hurt anybody's feelings, I regret it. They may like to note that at least in 1976, my heart was in the right place.
By focusing on aggressive interactions between whole individuals, Maynard Smith was able to make things very clear. It is easy to think of stable ratios of hawk bodies and dove bodies, because bodies are large things which we can see. But such interactions between genes sitting in different bodies are only the tip of the iceberg. The vast majority of significant interactions between genes in the evolutionarily stable set, the gene pool, go on within individual bodies. These interactions are difficult to see, for they take place within cells, notably the cells of developing embryos. Well-integrated bodies exist because they are the product of an evolutionarily stable set of selfish genes.
But I must return to the level of interactions between whole animals, which is the main subject of this book. For understanding aggression, it was convenient to treat individual animals as independent, selfish machines. This model breaks down when the individuals concerned are close relatives, brothers and sisters, cousins, parents and children. This is because relatives share a substantial proportion of their genes. Each selfish gene therefore has its loyalties divided between different bodies. This is explained in the next chapter.
Chapter 6. Genesmanship. What is the selfish gene? It's not just one single physical bit of DNA. Just as in the primeval soup, it is all replicas of a particular bit of DNA distributed throughout the world. If we allow ourselves the license of talking about genes as if they had conscious aims, always reassuring ourselves that we could translate our sloppy language back into respectable terms if we wanted to, we can ask the question, what is a single selfish gene trying to do? It is trying to get more numerous in the gene pool. Basically, it does this by helping to program the bodies in which it finds itself to survive and to reproduce. But now we are emphasizing that it is a distributed agency existing in many different individuals at once. The key point of this chapter is that a gene might be able to assist replicas of itself that are sitting in other bodies. If so, this would appear as individual altruism, but it would be brought about by gene selfishness.
Consider the gene for being an albino in man. In fact, several genes exist that can give rise to albinism, but I'm talking about just one of them. It is recessive, that is, it has to be present in double dose in order for the person to be an albino. This is true of about 1 in 20,000 of us. But it's also present in single dose in about 1 in 70 of us, and these individuals are not albinos. Since it is distributed in many individuals, a gene such as the albino gene could, in theory, assist its own survival in the gene pool by programming its bodies to behave altruistically towards other albino bodies, since these are known to contain the same gene. The albino gene should be quite happy if some of the bodies that it inhabits die, provided that in doing so they help other bodies containing the same gene to survive. If the albino gene could make one of its bodies save the lives of 10 albino bodies, then even the death of the altruist is amply compensated by the increased numbers of albino genes in the gene pool. Should we then expect albinos to be especially nice to each other? Actually, the answer is probably no. In order to see why not, we must temporarily abandon our metaphor of the gene as a conscious agent, because in this context it becomes positively misleading. We must translate back into respectable, if more long-winded, terms. Albino genes do not really want to survive or help other albino genes. But if the albino gene just happened to cause its bodies to behave altruistically towards other albinos, then automatically, willy-nilly, it would tend to become more numerous in the gene pool as a result. But in order for this to happen, the gene would have to have two independent effects on bodies. Not only must it confer its usual effect of a very pale complexion, it must also confer a tendency to be selectively altruistic towards individuals with a very pale complexion. Such a double effect gene could, if it existed, be very successful in the population.
Now, it is true that genes do have multiple effects, as was emphasized in Chapter 3. It is theoretically possible that a gene could arise which conferred an externally visible label, say a pale skin or a green beard, or anything conspicuous, and also a tendency to be specially nice to bearers of that conspicuous label. It's possible, but not particularly likely. Green-beardedness is just as likely to be linked to a tendency to develop ingrowing toenails or any other trait, and a fondness for green beards is just as likely to go together with an inability to smell freesias. It is not very probable that one and the same gene would produce both the right label and the right sort of altruism. Nevertheless, what may be called the green beard altruism effect is a theoretical possibility. An arbitrary label like a green beard is just one way in which a gene might recognize copies of itself in other individuals. Are there any other ways? A particularly direct possible way is the following. The possessor of an altruistic gene might be recognized simply by the fact that he does altruistic acts. A gene could prosper in the gene pool if it said the equivalent of, "Body, if A is drowning as a result of trying to save someone else from drowning, jump in and rescue A." The reason such a gene could do well is that there is a greater than average chance that A contains the same life-saving altruistic gene. The fact that A is seen to be trying to rescue somebody else is a label equivalent to a green beard. It is less arbitrary than a green beard, but it still seems rather implausible. Are there any plausible ways in which genes might recognize their copies in other individuals? The answer is yes. It is easy to show that close relatives, kin, have a greater than average chance of sharing genes. It has long been clear that this must be why altruism by parents towards their young is so common. What R.A. Fisher, J.B.S. Haldane, and especially W.D. Hamilton realized was that the same applies to other close relations, brothers and sisters, nephews and nieces, close cousins. If an individual dies in order to save 10 close relatives, one copy of the kin altruism gene may be lost, but a larger number of copies of the same gene is saved. A larger number is a bit vague, so is close relatives. We can do better than that, as Hamilton showed. His two papers of 1964 are among the most important contributions to social ethology ever written, and it's hard to understand why they've been so neglected by ethologists. His name does not even appear in the index of two major textbooks of ethology, both published in 1970. Fortunately, there are recent signs of a revival of interest in his ideas.
End note. Hamilton's 1964 papers are neglected no longer. The history of their earlier neglect and subsequent recognition makes an interesting quantitative study in its own right, a case study in the incorporation of a meme into the meme pool. I trace the progress of this meme in the notes to Chapter 11.
Hamilton's papers are rather mathematical, but it is easy to grasp the basic principles intuitively, without rigorous mathematics, though at the cost of some oversimplification.
The thing we want to calculate is the probability, or odds, that two individuals, say two sisters, share a particular gene. For simplicity, we shall assume that we are talking about genes that are rare in the gene pool as a whole.
End note. This device of assuming that we are talking about a gene that is rare in the population as a whole was a bit of a cheat to make the measuring of relatedness easy to explain. One of Hamilton's main achievements was to show that his conclusions follow regardless of whether the gene concerned is rare or common. This turns out to be an aspect of the theory that people find difficult to understand. The problem of measuring relatedness trips many of us up in the following way. Any two members of a species, whether they belong to the same family or not, usually share more than 90% of their genes. What then are we talking about when we speak of the relatedness between brothers as a half, or between first cousins as one-eighth? The answer is that brothers share a half of their genes over and above the 90% or whatever it is that all individuals share in any case. There is a kind of baseline relatedness shared by all members of a species, indeed to a lesser extent shared by members of other species. Altruism is expected towards individuals whose relatedness is higher than the baseline, whatever the baseline happens to be. In the first edition, I evaded the problem by using the trick of talking about rare genes. This is correct as far as it goes, but it doesn't go far enough. Hamilton himself wrote of genes being identical by descent, but this presents difficulties of its own, as Alan Graffen has shown. Other writers did not even acknowledge that there was a problem, and simply spoke of absolute percentages of shared genes, which is a definite and positive error. Such careless talk did lead to serious misunderstandings. For instance, a distinguished anthropologist, in the course of a bitter attack on sociobiology published in 1978, tried to argue that if we took kin selection seriously, we should expect all humans to be altruistic to one another, since all humans share more than 99% of their genes. I have given a brief reply to this error in my 12 Misunderstandings of Kin Selection. It rates as misunderstanding number 5. The other 11 misunderstandings are worth a look, too. Alan Graffen gives what may be the definitive solution to the problem of measuring relatedness in his geometric view of relatedness, which I shall not attempt to expound here. And in another paper, Natural Selection, Kin Selection, and Group Selection, Graffen clears up a further common and important problem, namely the widespread misuse of Hamilton's concept of inclusive fitness. He also tells us the right and wrong way to calculate costs and benefits to genetic relatives.
Most people share the gene for not being an albino, whether they are related to each other or not. The reason this gene is so common is that in nature, albinos are less likely to survive than non-albinos because, for example, the sun dazzles them and makes them relatively unlikely to see an approaching predator. We are not concerned with explaining the prevalence in the gene pool of such obviously good genes as the gene for not being an albino. We are interested in explaining the success of genes specifically as a result of their altruism. We can therefore assume that, at least in the early stages of this process of evolution, these genes are rare. Now, the important point is that even a gene that is rare in the population as a whole is common within a family. I contain a number of genes that are rare in the population as a whole, and you also contain genes that are rare in the population as a whole. The chance that we both contain the same rare genes is very small indeed. But the chances are good that my sister contains a particular rare gene that I contain, and the chances are equally good that your sister contains a rare gene in common with you. The odds are, in this case, exactly 50%, and it is easy to explain why. Suppose you contain one copy of the gene G. You must have received it either from your father or from your mother. For convenience, we can neglect various infrequent possibilities, that G is a new mutation, that both your parents had it, or that either of your parents had two copies of it.
Suppose it was your father who gave you the gene. Then every one of his ordinary body cells contained one copy of G. Now you will remember that when a man makes a sperm, he doles out half his genes to it. There is therefore a 50% chance that the sperm that begot your sister received the gene G. If, on the other hand, you received G from your mother, exactly parallel reasoning shows that half of her eggs must have contained G. Once again, the chances are 50% that your sister contains G. This means that if you had 100 brothers and sisters, approximately 50 of them would contain any particular rare gene that you contain. It also means that if you have 100 rare genes, approximately 50 of them are in the body of any one of your brothers or sisters.
You can do the same kind of calculation for any degree of kinship you like. An important relationship is that between parent and child. If you have one copy of gene H, the chance that any particular one of your children has it is 50%, because half your sex cells contain H, and any particular child was made from one of those sex cells. If you have one copy of gene J, the chance that your father also had J is 50%, because you received half your genes from him and half from your mother. For convenience, we can use an index of relatedness, which expresses the chance of a gene being shared between two relatives. The relatedness between two brothers is a half, since half the genes possessed by one brother will be found in the other. This is an average figure. By the luck of the meiotic draw, it is possible for particular pairs of brothers to share more or fewer genes than this. The relatedness between parent and child is always exactly a half. It is rather tedious going through the calculations from first principles every time, so here is a rough-and-ready rule for working out the relatedness between any two individuals, A and B. You may find it useful in making your will or in interpreting apparent resemblances in your own family. It works for all simple cases, but breaks down where incestuous mating occurs, and in certain insects, as we shall see. First, identify all the common ancestors of A and B. For instance, the common ancestors of a pair of first cousins are their shared grandfather and grandmother. Once you've found a common ancestor, it is of course logically true that all his ancestors are common to A and B as well. However, we ignore all but the most recent common ancestors. In this sense, first cousins have only two common ancestors. If B is a lineal descendant of A, for instance, his great-grandson, then A himself is the common ancestor we are looking for. Having located the common ancestors of A and B, count the generation distance as follows. Starting at A, climb up the family tree until you hit a common ancestor, then climb down again to B. The total number of steps up the tree and then down again is the generation distance. For instance, if A is B's uncle, the generation distance is 3. The common ancestor is A's father, say, and B's grandfather. Starting at A, you have to climb up one generation in order to hit the common ancestor. Then to get down to B, you have to descend 2 generations on the other side. Therefore, the generation distance is 1 plus 2 equals 3. Having found the generation distance between A and B via a particular common ancestor, calculate that part of their relatedness for which that ancestor is responsible. To do this, multiply a half by itself once for each step of the generation distance. If the generation distance is 3, this means calculate a half times a half times a half, or a half cubed. If the generation distance via a particular ancestor is equal to g steps, the portion of relatedness due to that ancestor is a half to the power g. But this is only part of the relatedness between A and B. If they have more than one common ancestor, we have to add on the equivalent figure for each ancestor. It is usually the case that the generation distance is the same for all common ancestors of a pair of individuals. Therefore, having worked out the relatedness between A and B due to any one of the ancestors, all you have to do in practice is to multiply by the number of ancestors. First cousins, for instance, have 2 common ancestors, and the generation distance via each one is 4. Therefore, their relatedness is 2 × 1/2 to the power 4 equals 1/8. If A is B's great-grandchild, the generation distance is 3, and the number of common ancestors is 1, B himself. So the relatedness is 1 × 1/2 cubed, which equals 1/8. Genetically speaking, your first cousin is equivalent to a great-grandchild. Similarly, you are just as likely to take after your uncle, relatedness equals 2 × 1/2 cubed equals 1/4, as after your grandfather, relatedness equals 1 × 1/2 squared equals 1/4. For relationships as distant as third cousin, 2 × 1/2 to the power 8 equals 1/128, we are getting down near the baseline probability that a particular gene possessed by A will be shared by any random individual taken from the population. A third cousin is not far from being equivalent to any old Tom, Dick or Harry, as far as an altruistic gene is concerned. A second cousin, relatedness equals 1/32, is only a little bit special. A first cousin, somewhat more so, 1/8. Full brothers and sisters, and parents and children, are very special, 1/2. And identical twins, relatedness equals 1, just as special as oneself. Uncles and aunts, nephews and nieces, grandparents and grandchildren, and half-brothers and half-sisters are intermediate with a relatedness of 1/4.
Now we are in a position to talk about genes for kin altruism much more precisely. A gene for suicidally saving 5 cousins would not become more numerous in the population, but a gene for saving 5 brothers, or 10 first cousins, would. The minimum requirement for a suicidal altruistic gene to be successful is that it should save more than 2 siblings, or children, or parents, or more than 4 half-siblings, or uncles, aunts, nephews, nieces, grandparents, grandchildren, or more than 8 first cousins, etc. Such a gene, on average, tends to live on in the bodies of enough individuals saved by the altruist to compensate for the death of the altruist itself. If an individual could be sure that a particular person was his identical twin, he should be exactly as concerned for his twin's welfare as for his own. Any gene for twin altruism is bound to be carried by both twins, therefore if one dies heroically to save the other, the gene lives on. 9-banded armadillos are born in a litter of identical quadruplets. As far as we know, no feats of heroic self-sacrifice have been reported for young armadillos, but it has been pointed out that some strong altruism is definitely to be expected, and it would be well worth somebody's while going out to South America to have a look.
End note. No developments are reported on the armadillo front, but some spectacular new facts have come to light for another group of cloning animals, aphids. It has long been known that aphids, such as greenfly, reproduce asexually as well as sexually. If you see a crowd of aphids on a plant, the chances are that they are all members of an identical female clone, while those on the next door plant will be members of a different clone. Theoretically, these conditions are ideal for the evolution of kin-selected altruism. No actual instances of aphid altruism were known, however, until sterile soldiers were discovered in a Japanese species of aphids by Shigeyuki Aoki in 1977, just too late to appear in the first edition of this book. Aoki has since found the phenomenon in a number of different species and has good evidence that it has evolved at least 4 times independently in different groups of aphids. Briefly, Aoki's story is this. Aphid soldiers are an anatomically distinct caste, just as distinct as the caste of traditional social insects, like ants. They are larvae that do not mature to full adulthood, and they are therefore sterile. They neither look nor behave like their non-soldier larval contemporaries, to whom they are, however, genetically identical. Soldiers are typically larger than non-soldiers. They have extra big front legs, which make them look almost scorpion-like, and they have sharp horns pointing forward from the head. They use these weapons to fight and kill would-be predators. They often die in the process, but even if they don't, it is still correct to think of them as genetically altruistic, because they're sterile. In terms of selfish genes, what is going on here? Aoki does not mention precisely what determines which individuals become sterile soldiers and which become normal reproductive adults, but we can safely say that it must be an environmental, not a genetic difference. Obviously, since the sterile soldiers and the normal